The Trump administration is looking to open Florida's waters to offshore drilling. Florida's Democrats and Republicans say, no way. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. On Monday, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz introduced a bill to ban offshore drilling for decades. It has bipartisan support. We're going to look at how the battle for Florida's waters could become a hot topic in the 2020 campaign. We'll also take a look at the Mueller report and its findings on the reported hacking of a Florida county during the 2016 elections. Also, in the past, students might spend time going on field trips to the museum or the ballet. A new program in Miami Beach will bring the arts to the classroom. And finally, our April book club conversation about Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls by T. Kira Madden. We'll hear from our book club members about what they loved in this coming-of-age story out of Boca Raton. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. Offshore drilling remains a very controversial issue in Florida. The Trump administration is considering auctioning off Florida waters for drilling permits, particularly in the resource-rich Gulf of Mexico. Now, the plan remains politically unpopular in the state of Florida, where conservative lawmakers in the legislature, up to Governor Ron DeSantis, are in opposition. And the Trump administration may face another roadblock. Yesterday, Democratic Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz announced legislation that would put a moratorium on offshore drilling along Florida's coast for nearly two decades. The Sun Sentinel's Anthony Mann is following the story. He's also been looking into Florida's connections within the Mueller report, which we're going to get to as well. Let's start with our conversation with Anthony. Tony, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks. Glad to be here.
Let's understand what the Marine Oil Spill Prevention Act actually says about offshore drilling. This, again, the bill that's been being pushed right now by Congresswoman Schultz, Wasserman Schultz.
Well, the main and clear point is that it would establish a permanent ban on oil and gas drilling around Florida's coastlines, and that takes in both the Atlantic and the Gulf Coast. That's the main part of it. There are some other provisions about studies and provisions for oil spill cleanups, but the key thing is a permanent ban on drilling around Florida.
This bill, how much of it was inspired by the Deepwater Horizon oil spill? That was the BP rig that collapsed, that exploded, I should say, and created a catastrophe back in 2010.
Well, certainly that's in the back of the minds of a lot of people in Florida when people look at what could happen if there's a problem with some kind of drilling offshore. The sponsors of the legislation, Congresswoman Wasserman Schultz and others, used that as a point to illustrate, a way to illustrate what they want to avoid with this legislation. And so they announced it on the anniversary of the day that the Deepwater Horizon actually sank. I think really what the motivation here is the potential threat that Florida's coastlines could be subjected to offshore drilling. And so then they're using Deepwater Horizon as an example of, you better not let this happen because this is what could be a result.
The original legislation specifically states a moratorium on drilling in the Gulf of Mexico, but does that mean the east coast of Florida would be open to drilling?
No, the sponsors of this legislation say it's what they're doing is a permanent ban on oil and gas drilling around the coastlines, not just the Gulf Coast.
It is important to note that there's a bipartisan nature to this legislation. We know Democrat Debbie Wasserman Schultz introduced the bill, but who are the Republicans who are also in support of this?
Well, that's something that makes this kind of interesting. One of the notable main co-sponsors of it is Congressman Matt Gaetz, who's a Republican from the Panhandle, and many people know him as possibly Florida's most pronounced and outspoken supporter of President Trump. He's a very conservative guy and not somebody who's aligned with Debbie Wasserman Schultz very often. And so you have these two people leading this effort, and that makes for an interesting coalition. We also have Congressman Vern Buchanan, who has a Gulf Coast district in the Sarasota area, and our own Congresswoman Debbie Mercosell Powell, who, of course, has the Keys. And, you know, we have obvious interests in a lot of these members of Congress, but the political pairings are pretty interesting.
What have we heard about why the Republican support for this bill? You know, what are they saying about it?
Well, I think the key is Republicans, while you know they may like the fossil fuel industry or may have been supportive of the fossil fuel industry, this is a very important issue for Florida. If we did have a spill that really hit our coastline really badly, it would be catastrophic for the marine industry and for the tourism industry. And I think even people who normally don't want to regulate industry and want support the fossil fuel industry also don't want lots and lots of oil washing up on Florida's coasts.
You know, you talk about Republicans who are on board with the president. Governor Ron DeSantis, again, a Trump guy, is also in opposition to offshore drilling. How does that play out?
Well, I mean, he's going to have some influence with the president, or we assume he has influence with the president. They're pretty close allies. And again, he doesn't want a catastrophe in Florida. And he also knows that the vast majority of people in Florida are opposed to the idea of offshore drilling. And so he has that in with President Trump, and it might help. Of course, also President Trump might be influenced because he certainly wouldn't want oil washing up on Palm Beach, where he has his Mar-a-Lago club.
That's an interesting point. So what do we know about how Floridians feel? What does poll data tell us?
We know that Floridians really dislike the idea of offshore drilling. It was actually just last month that Quinnipiac put a question in its Florida poll, and it was overwhelming. It was 64% of Floridians oppose offshore drilling off of Florida. And that was true in every demographic group, young, old men, women, different racial breakdowns, except for Republicans. Republicans, there's a slim majority, 54% support it. But in every other group, it's significant opposition.
So where are Trump's plans now? Where do they stand in exploring offshore drilling along the coast?
Well, the last that I was aware of, the administration has been advancing offshore drilling around the country, and that goes through a complicated rulemaking process. And I don't know precisely where that stands in terms of the Florida coast.
If the Trump administration pushes this hard, what do you see? How do you see this playing out in 2020?
Well, you know, it depends on how if we think voters decide based on issues, even issues that are very important to them, or do they decide on personalities and whether they like President Trump or don't like President Trump. The realistic truth is that even if they did allow exploration and leases, I mean, nothing is really would happen in time for the 2020 election. So we wouldn't have a disaster that would be washing up on our shores that would have an immediate impact on the 2020 election. So it might be a little bit more distant than some environmental advocates would hope, or a little bit more theoretical.
I'm talking with Anthony Mann of the Sun Sentinel. Yesterday, Congresswoman Debbie Wasserman Schultz brought forth new legislation to ban offshore drilling in Florida. Mann has also been following Florida's connections to the Mueller report into Russian interference in the U.S. election. Let's move over to that part of the conversation now. There were a number of references to Florida throughout that report. Tell us about the Internet Research Agency. This is run out of St. Petersburg, Russia, and their focus on South Florida specifically.
Well, it's pretty interesting. The Mueller report had 30 references to Florida, and of course that always attracts, we always figure there's a Florida connection to all these big stories. And one of the interesting things was this Internet Research Agency. It's been talked about a lot. It's basically a troll farm that was run out of St. Petersburg, Russia, and people there had assignments to try and influence the U.S. elections. And among the things that happened in Florida was one of their fake Twitter accounts. Of course, this caught me because the Sun Sentinel concentrates a lot of its efforts on Broward County. And one of the Twitter accounts run by the Internet Research Agency, put out a tweet in which it claimed that there were voting irregularities in Broward County. And this was just before the election. So it, breaking news, voter fraud, tens of thousands of ineligible Hillary Clinton votes were being reported in Broward County, Florida. That was picked up and retweeted by none other than Donald Trump Jr. So we don't know what effect any of these individual things had, but it was part of this effort to influence people and stir up trouble before the election. The Internet Research Agency also organized rallies supporting Trump or opposing Clinton. And some of those rallies were in Florida in 2016. And at least in one case, Trump's Facebook page praised the a rally that was held in Miami, a Trump sign waving day, and it praised this rally and said thank you for support in Miami. And this was really a fake organized. This was organized by this fake entity in South Florida. That's another example.
Roger Stone, the political operative based out of Fort Lauderdale, was also included. How?
Yes. Well, the key thing involving Roger Stone, the issues for which he was indicted in January, weren't a focus of the Mueller report because it redacted information about ongoing investigations. But there was some interesting material that related to Stone in talking about something that they decided not to pursue an investigation. And it talked about a move by some Florida-based Russians who met with Stone down here in South Florida to try and peddle him, sell him information that was supposedly negative about Hillary Clinton. The Mueller report says that Stone refused the offer and that he told these intermediaries that the Trump campaign wouldn't pay for opposition research. But it again showed that Stone was intimately involved in trying to purvey dirt about Hillary Clinton and use that to influence the election.
And then there was Aaron Nevins, who's also been a longtime political operative in South Florida. How's he connected to the Russian hacking of Democratic Party emails?
That, again, is something that we've known about for a while. Nevins, when, if you'll recall, Guccifer 2.0 was a website, an online entity that was operated by Russian military intelligence. And it was putting out hacked information from the Democratic Congressional Campaign Committee during 2016. And Nevins got in touch with them because he's a political operative and a consultant and does some lobbying. And they sent him a ton of information. And he then farmed that out. And it was really leaked insider plans and analyses of Democratic candidates and candidate vulnerabilities. It's unclear that he knew precisely where the information came from, that it, you know, who stole it or that it was Russians. But he has not been charged with any crime. But that is something that has come out during the course of the Mueller investigation and some people that were Russians that were indicted. But again, not Nevins himself.
Well, you know, one of the troubling findings from the Mueller report is scant details. The suggestion that one Florida county system was impacted by Russian interference on Election Day. What does the Mueller report suggest happened?
Well, and a key, Lewis, is what you just said. It's really scant. It is so vague that we don't really know what happened. It said that the operation was able to gain access to the network of at least one Florida county government. Now, we're generally people are assuming that that was an elections office in some county, but we don't really know what happened, and we don't really know what there was access to.
And we don't know where.
We don't know where. The three big South Florida supervisors of elections offices in Miami-Dade, Broward, and Palm Beach counties have all said it wasn't them, but we don't really know what happened and where, and if it even really got into an elections office as opposed to some other entity of a county government somewhere. The elections people emphasize, they really push this reassuring line that the actual systems that tabulate votes aren't connected in a way that they could have been intruded on by this system. Possibly voter registration could have. I don't know that that really reassures people, but the actual tabulating and voting, they emphatically maintain, was not and could not have been affected.
And former Senator Bill Nelson, in the lead up to the election, he raised concerns about Russian interference in the election.
Yes, he did. He was sounding an alarm last year that there were troubles from Russian interference and that there were inroads being made in Florida. And that was very controversial because he didn't offer specifics. It was very general. It was knocked down. It was in the heat of his campaign against then Governor Rick Scott. And of course, Governor Scott is in charge of the Secretary of State's office, which is in charge of elections. And this Scott and his people were really knocking down Nelson's reports. And a lot of people actually kind of mocked him because there was really no way to verify it. We don't know if this is what Nelson was talking about. We haven't heard from him since then, and we don't know if it's the same thing.
Could Florida Secretary of State demand an unredacted copy of the Mueller report to get to the bottom of that controversy?
Well, the Mueller report really had very little information, and it's not clear that anything that was in redactions dealt with that. It talked about the FBI having a belief that this one county system was intruded on, and the Mueller's office said that it didn't act to verify that belief. So this is really in the FBI's court and not really so much Mueller's.
All right. Well, you know, it's one of these things. It's going to be talked about for a while. So it's not a story going away anytime soon.
Absolutely not.
We've been talking with Anthony Mann of the Sun Sentinel. You can find links to his stories on these issues on our social media, WLRN Sundial. Anthony, always a pleasure.
Thanks, Lewis. I appreciate it.
All right. Still to come, how do you teach math through art or science through ballet? It's not just about STEM anymore. It's about STEAM. We'll explain coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. Well, students in Miami Beach are going to see a change to their curriculum. No, not more tests. Actually, they're getting more art. Through a new program with the city, students will be exposed to art from museums like the Bass, ballet dance instructors from Miami City Ballet, and musicians from New World Symphony. In February, the City of Miami Beach, in collaboration with Miami-Dade County Public Schools System, launched the STEAM Plus pilot program, STEM with Arts or Science, Technology, Engineering, Art and Math. The idea is to find ways in which the arts intersect with math and science programs. Corinne Ia is the Education Outreach and Special Programs Coordinator at the Bass Museum at Miami Beach, and she joins us now. I did say that right, didn't I?
Yes, you did.
Thank you. Great to have you. Thanks for coming in.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I'm so excited to be here.
You know, there's always been that debate about, you know, protecting the arts and schools. How do you deal with that? Because budgets and everything else. Let's talk about how STEAM works. This, again, STEM, but now with the arts.
With the arts,
so
yeah.
STEAM, how does it work?
Yeah, so S is for science, T is for technology, E is for engineering, A, of course, is arts, and then M with math. And basically what we're doing is we're going into schools, partnering these culture institutions, and creating curriculum that integrates the arts with core curriculum STEAM or STEM classes.
It's actually bringing, like teaching biology with ballet.
Exactly.
Or something like that.
Exactly, yeah. So we're using the arts to further expand what the teachers are working on with the students. So, for example, in biology classes, the Bass Museum has gone in and created these three-dimensional beaded bracelets or keychains. And basically what we've done with the students is we've created a chart, and the students created their keychains by creating DNA samples and sequences. And they coordinated, you know, A and T, G and C, both create a certain sequence, and they match that with the DNA model using glass beads. So it's really intricate, and it's fun to watch the students explore the arts. We found that a lot of students, unfortunately, haven't explored some of these arts, and it's just been amazing to watch.
How long have you been involved in trying to combine the two?
So I've been involved since the initial thought. This is all thanks to Mayor Dan Gilbert of Miami City Miami Beach. Miami Beach. Thank you. And so he, you know, he took a step back and he saw all of these wonderful world-class institutions that we have here in the city. And he said, how can we bring these to the schools? So he contacted Superintendent Carvalho, and he spoke with all of the principals at these six feeder pattern schools. And they decided, listen, we're all trying to be STEAM designated. And the process of being STEAM designated is this really rough rubric that takes a lot of effort. And we're finding that each of the schools has STEAM liaisons, but these STEAM liaisons often also teach in the classrooms. So that's taking away time from them teaching and all of the lesson planning and curriculum that they already work on and adding on another load of work. So the whole point of this initiative is to bring these cultural institutions into these schools, but also aid the schools and help them get that STEAM designation.
Why do you want to have that STEAM designation?
So the STEAM designation is kind of like the IB program. It's a wonderful designation that sets your school apart. Some of our schools have never been STEAM designated, and then some of the schools that we're working with have actually participated, and they got participant level or bronze. So there's four different levels. It's gold, silver, bronze, or participant. And a majority of the schools all expressed how hard it's been to actually go through the process of becoming STEAM designated, because it is a lot of work. It's, you know, STEAM visits, creating partnerships, which is mainly what this program does. And then, of course, integrating that STEAM curriculum and ensuring that all students get access to STEAM classes.
This is an interesting idea. How do you become STEAM designated? You say it's a lot of work.
Mm-hmm.
Is it sitting down with the is it having groups like yours
mm-hmm.
come in, work with the teachers on their curriculum,
mm-hmm.
or is it you're coming in from time to time and just doing some cool projects?
It's a little bit of both. So to become STEAM designated, it's a process that's overseen by Miami-Dade County Public Schools. Mr. Carvalho has an amazing team, Mr. Marcias and Mr. Carranza, that oversee the STEAM program. And basically, they come in and they visit your school, and they see, you know, how are you integrating STEAM? They walk around the school, they check your billboards, your lesson plans, your classes, and then of course the teachers have to provide STEAM 5.0 lesson plans. And what it means to be 5.0 is that you're incorporating all five elements of STEAM: science, technology, and engineering, arts, and math.
Let's talk about, because you started to touch on one a second ago,
mm-hmm.
but let's pick a class.
Mm-hmm.
Let's say we're doing a science class, and, you know, one of the things I'd read about is how ballet is being tied in with science.
Mm-hmm.
How would that work? How does that look?
Yeah, so Miami City Ballet has done an amazing job going into schools. One of their partners is actually Biscayne Elementary. And how they tied into science was the students were actually working on gravity, push and pull. And so the students learned how gravity works in the dance world, but also in the real world and the world around us. And they created a movement. And they actually put on a performance at the end of the program where they explained how gravity works and how push and pull works by creating these superhero characters and integrating that science aspect to it.
So it's not just something you're going to be reading in a book or on your computer.
Correct.
Now you're seeing you're seeing it happen. The other thing too is this is in the past, or at least look, going back to my day when I was growing up, we would take a field trip somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
And you'd go and go to the ballet, go to the museum. Mm-hmm. In this case, you're going to the schools.
That's
they
correct.
Never have to leave.
Correct.
The students.
Yeah. So through the program, we're going into the schools during school class time. And then they're also invited to take field trips to the institutions. So we are still doing those field trips, but we're ensuring that the field trips are geared towards the STEAM program. So when they visit the BAS, they're not only looking at the contemporary art that we have, but they're also integrating STEAM within the art component. So when we look at the Miami Mountain on Collins Park, how was the Miami Mountain created? What was the engineering and technology that took place in order to create the Miami Mountain? How did the artists put together and work on and all those different elements that it took to create that piece, which is a giant, beautiful neon boulder sculpture that is over, I believe, 20 feet high. So
I wanted to get another sense, too, of how else. What's another, idea of what it would look like? And you brought props.
Mm-hmm.
Go figure. It's like a teacher
when
you bring props. But what else would a student be doing? How do they incorporate again, the arts into their regular lessons.
Of course. So Young Musicians Unite has done an amazing job. And what they're actually doing is they're creating a coding class in which students are coding, but they're also creating music through programming. Another project that we've done is with Nautilus Middle School. We actually partnered up with their theatrical department, and we created these beautiful costumes. And the students learned about all the mathematics, the science, engineering, and everything it takes to put on a production. They learned about lighting. They learned about all the technology it takes. Just here being in the studio, you see all of this that takes place. And it's incredible how students don't realize how there's science and all of these elements in everything we do. You can find STEAM or STEM everywhere you go, but it takes a little bit of time to connect it all together.
Now you're going to make me think about my studio and how things work in here, and I didn't even think about that. Mm-hmm. You know what? Because you've been doing this now for a little bit of time now. Mm-hmm. I wondered if you had an anecdote, if you had something about how the students had responded. And I'm really curious about especially students who may have been struggling.
Yeah.
And if how this may have helped them.
Yeah, so we've definitely had wonderful feedback from the students. A lot of the students have come up to us and other teaching artists and other cultural institutions mentioning how they're not book learners. They don't learn just by reading and kind of lecturing. They're more physical, visual learners. So we found that there's different methods of teaching and learning, and that through this program, we've able to explore that and expose students to various different ways of learning. So hands-on activities, applying real-world situations into the classroom and having them work hands-on has really assisted our students.
I'm talking with Corinne Nia. She's Education Outreach and Special Programs Coordinator at the Bass Museum at Miami Beach. Corinne has been working directly with schools and cultural institutions around the city as part of Miami-Dade County Public Schools' new STEAM pilot program. STEAM, again, stands for Science, Technology, Engineering, Art, and Math. Performing arts is being added to school curriculums at Miami Beach, and she's telling us a little bit of how all of that works. How did these cultural institutions, these big institutions, get involved with the schools? How did that happen?
Yeah, well, we've had a lot of support from the city of Miami Beach and the mayor, of course. And so we went out and we contacted all of the local cultural institutions to say, hey, you know, are you willing and are you able? Is this something that you're interested in? And we got a lot of amazing feedback, and they all said definitely yes. We were very interested. We'd love to do that outreach and get into all of these schools. So it's been an amazing process and program, and we're extremely grateful.
Now, the mayor of Miami Beach, Mayor Gelber, on board with this, but part of it also is because of the cost.
Mm-hmm.
There is a cost. What
definitely
is that cost, and it's covered by the city or the school district?
It's covered by the city. So Mayor Gelber and all of the commissioners actually approved of this budget. And they funded this program, and if it weren't for them, this program would not be going on right now.
And what was the budget for the first year?
I believe it was $122,000.
Now, this, again, is just for six schools in Miami Beach.
Mm-hmm.
So this is a pilot program because eventually this is something that you want to spread across the entire district.
Yeah.
So how long are you going to, will this pilot program last? How are you measuring success to see how you would do that?
Yeah, so we're sending out surveys to all the students, parents, and administration that's been affected or have worked with the STEAM program. And then, of course, we're reaching out to the community during special events that we hold as culminating events to see what their reaction is and how we're doing. The pilot program ends in June because we also follow the academic school year. And then we hope to get it started back again in August. And hopefully in August, we'll have some additional schools and additional cultural institutions. Like we met with Common Threads, which is a wonderful culinary organization. And they usually serve underprivileged schools. And they go in and they teach culinary skills to students. So we're already discussing with them and other institutions to see how we can incorporate them into this program.
Is there a way to measure student success with this?
Definitely. So we're going to be reviewing all of the student test scores, and then we're also going to see what grade level the school is at the end of the school year. Each year, schools are graded and they're considered A school, B school. So we're going to look at that. And then, of course, we're also going to measure by seeing if they they qualify for that STEAM designation. So do they actually receive that gold, bronze, silver, or participate STEAM designation at the end of the school year?
Is there a STEAM program somewhere in the country that you could look to as the model and say, well, they've got it. They figured it out.
There are a few. I believe New York has an amazing background in STEAM. But STEAM is relatively new. Right now, you know, we had STEM at first, and STEAM is kind of starting up. Miami-Dade County Public Schools and Superintendent Carvalho has done an amazing job of encouraging everyone to become STEAM designated. This is definitely a stepping stone in the STEAM realm, but we're extremely excited.
My understanding is there's a big project coming up here in June, right? And students are working on a giant quilt.
Well, it's actually this Sunday.
Okay.
So
oh, okay. No. Sorry about that.
Yeah.
Okay.
So on April 28th, which is this Sunday, between 2 and 4 p.m., we're going to actually have a free family STEAM celebration day at the BAS. And basically, we're going to be exhibiting all of the artwork that we've been creating with the students through the STEAM Plus pilot program. In a majority of the schools, we've actually created these beautiful burlap patches where students designed using oil pastels and then added different beads and collage paper. And, you know, they explored endangered animals, global warming, the life cycle of plants, and they transformed that into their beautiful little quilt patch. And then we're connecting all the quilt pieces and we're making a giant tapestry. So we're very excited. We're uniting the community.
And that's coming up this weekend.
This weekend. Sunday, April 28th between 2 and 4 p.m. And it's free to the public, and we're very excited.
So let's not think STEM anymore. Let's focus on STEAM. Add the arts to it. Mm-hmm. Again, Corinne Ia is Education Outreach and Special Programs Coordinator at the Bass Museum of Miami Beach. We have links at our social media if you want to know more about how the arts are being brought into the school system, into the curriculum with students in Miami Beach, and hopefully something that goes district-wide soon. Corinne, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Good luck.
Thank you.
Thank
I
you
appreciate
so much.
It.
Well, still to come, we're going to talk with a couple of folks who read the April title of the Sundial Book Club, Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls. It's coming up next. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, this month at the Sundial Book Club, we tackle the new book, Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls. It's the memoir from T. Kira Madden, who grew up here in Boca Raton. It's a book that's more a collection of essays about different moments in Madden's life, some of them harrowing, others oddly funny, and you'll find yourself laughing at times when you wonder if it's appropriate to laugh. Have you finished reading the book? What do you think about this collection of stories and about how Madden tackled issues like coming out to her parents or dealing with her mother's substance abuse or her father's death? You can find the book club on our Facebook page. Just look up Sundial Book Club. Love to have you. It's free to join. And we're joined now by WLRN reporter Jessica Bakeman, who, by the way, pitched us this book in the first place, so that's why we're reading it. Jessica, welcome.
Thanks, Lewis.
And by the way, great choice. Loved it.
I agree.
It was. It was a very interesting read. And Sundial Book Club fan Susan Edgar Lee joins us. Susan, welcome.
Hi there.
Great to have you both. All right. First of all, Jessica, let me start with you because you pitched the book. How did you find it?
Okay, so I'm so excited you're asking me this, Lewis. I moved to Florida almost 4 years ago, and I'm from upstate New York originally, and I just have really loved reading about Florida. So, like, pretty much everything I've read since I've moved to Florida has been a book about Florida by a Florida author, and I try to read mostly books by women. So I was following Kristen Arnett. She's another queer writer, actually. She's a lesbian librarian in Orlando. She had a book of short stories, and she actually has a novel coming out that I have also pitched to the Sundial Book Club that's called Mostly Dead Things. But she was tweeting about T. Kira Madden, and so I followed them both on Twitter, and then I saw all of this stuff. And frankly, I was really attracted to the cover design of the book, and it's cool when you can interact with authors on social media and you can get a sense of like who they are, and it kind of builds that buzz. So that's why I was interested.
And look, that's the whole idea with the book club, is that we want to focus on stories that either take place in South Florida or are some way connected, or at least the author is connected. And this is both, because, I mean, T. Keir Madden grew up in South Florida, actually had a little bit of time in Coconut Grove, grew up in Boca Raton. And
Parkland, I guess, right? It's in the book. It says Parkland, Coral Springs.
She's South Florida. I mean, she's been around South Florida. So it's great to read the story because I recognize some of the neighborhoods anyway. But Susan, for you, what compelled you to want to read the story? Because not all book club members are going to want to read our choices.
Right. I totally don't remember when I saw the first blurb about it, but it wasn't from you guys. It was either the New York Times or maybe the San Francisco Chronicle readers' suggestions. I have only lived here a year and a half, so I even have some questions for you Floridians or people who have been here longer, but something about it caught my eye before you guys suggested it. So it's on my watch list.
So you have to, and I want to hear some of these questions you have, but after finishing it, what resonated most with you? What was it about this book?
Okay, it grew on me, because at first I thought, I'm just kind of tolerating. I'm like, the crisis, and needed to, you know, take breaks now and then. But after I finished it, it was just the raw, uncensored, relatable aspect of the memoir. And when I look back at, because I actually didn't read it in print form, I listened to it on Audible.
And T. Keir Madden voiced it.
She
narrated it.
Yes, she did. And so some things hit you a different way when you're just listening to it. And I didn't realize that actually, these really were a series of essays that she then crafted into this really wonderful memoir. So it just totally elevated it, the way she changed it, to kind of order them. And even though it happens out of chronological order, it's kind of like you're just experiencing her life with her. And so just the raw emotions... I don't know, like she broke it up into three acts, one, act two, and act three. And the first one was more about her childhood. And so you start finding out about all these painful things.
Yeah.
Yes. And then act two, I would subtitle Hold On to the Tail of a Kite. and then three, it's... Okay, it's the beginning of the end. She's becoming an adult.
And some big reveals.
Yeah,
at
some
the end.
Big reveals, which I'm not into spoilers.
Yeah, no.
But it's literary magic.
And we won't. I don't want to either, because people just read the book. But Jessica, real quickly, what stood out for you? What resonated most with you? I know there are a lot of issues she tackled that I mentioned, but if there's one thing you would say, this is why this book touched me most.
Wow. I mean, it's so raw. She just lays bare so many things that, like, there's probably 10 different things in the book that I would imagine would be really difficult for anybody to say, you know, whole world, listen to this or read this story and know about. You know, she was sexually assaulted. She grappled with questions about her sexual identity and feeling shame as a child and not understanding. And, you know, she talks about it. And I follow her on social media. And it's really interesting because you kind of get these little like sidebars of what's going on, you know, and she's talked about like how it was difficult for her mother, given that she was like laying bare so much about her mother's personal life and stuff that I'm sure her mother's not super proud of, like, you know, her behavior as she was struggling with substance abuse and raising a child.
And both her parents had substance abuse issues.
Yeah, and you know, I mean, it's like her dad was married and had kids, you know, and so she was born in this sort of situation where like her mom was they were having an affair, and you know, so it's just like so many different elements that can evoke like shame, and she's just like open with them. She's like, here are all the different things that made me who I am.
She does not hold back anything. That is true. We also heard from one of our other Sundial Book Club members, Kim Ko, talked about how this book resonated with her.
For me, what resonated was around loving an alcoholic or an addict. And, you know, I think that she was very lucky that her parents or her mother found recovery. I didn't have the same kind of outcome as her, but what I thought was fascinating is the juxtaposition of your caring. You know, you care so much for someone, and then they act so crazy, and you hate them, and it's just this horrible walking of a knife's edge. And I thought she did a really great job of portraying that about everything, about friends, about relationships in general, how it's kind of a razor sharp which side you land on with people. My overall impression was that she portrayed her life and the people in her life with a great accuracy, in that you don't just constantly love somebody. It just doesn't happen like that. You know, I mean, it's constantly fraught with nuances, and with someone with substance abuse, it's fraught with horrible ups and downs and heartbreak.
And again, that's Sundial Book Club member Kim Coe talking about what resonated with her. I'm speaking with WLRN reporter Jessica Bakeman and WLRN listener and Sundial Book Club member Susan Edgar Lee. And we're talking about the April title for the Sundial Book Club, Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls by T. Kira Madden. And we talked to her a couple weeks ago. We aired the interview last week. The interview is online at WLRN.org. And here's something that I asked T. Kira Madden about, was the fact that she's a young woman. I mean, young and a lot younger than me, and yet she wrote a memoir. And I asked her, was this a good time to write it, or did you want to wait a little longer? And well, here's her take.
There was always a condescension of, you know, you, what do you know? You haven't lived your life yet. Go out and live your life before you write any nonfiction. And I think that kind of scared me off of nonfiction and memoir until I wrote this book. But I think that's a really false idea. I think that can be a gendered idea, it can be an ageist idea. And I think the more I've read memoir and nonfiction, the more I realize it's so not about the sprawl of life, or at least it doesn't have to be, as much as it has to be about an experience, which is sometimes a single experience that's rendered beautifully and vastly. The idea that it has to be about an entire lifetime to be worthy of one's time is a false one.
I mean, the book resonated with me on different levels. I'm a Gen Xer. I'm a bit older, so I didn't see it the way she did. But Jessica, she's more your age.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say this. One of the things that was really interesting for me was she's like 1 year older than me. So all of our cultural references were the same. You know, when she was talking about like Hanson and like no scrubs, you know, I was like, I listened to that also in sixth grade or whatever. And so that was cool, because that's rare. I don't remember ever connecting to a book in that specific way. Like, oh, we literally grew up at the same time. I wanted to comment on what she said about the memoir idea and her age. And I think that's really interesting. For one, if anybody reads this book, I don't think that you could deny that she's lived more than enough life to write a memoir. There were so many dramatic twists and turns. But also, you know, I kept seeing people like tweet at her, are you going to write a sequel? And actually she did like an Instagram, you know, thing where she answered questions the other day. And she said that like a sequel is pretty much done, but her family needs a little bit of time to like take a deep breath and heal a little bit from like having so much of their personal life out there. But it was interesting to me, because I never think about a memoir, a sequel to a memoir. You know what I mean? Because you think of a memoir as like an autobiography.
Here's my life.
You know
yeah.
what I mean? But you know, there obviously there's kind of a cliffhanger at the end of it, and so certainly you can see her exploring that issue in a sequel. But also, she said that she's working on a novel that she said is a lesbian take on Phantom of the Opera. So she's got a reader here in those two books.
She wants to write fiction, and she never, what she said in the interview, she never wanted to tackle this, but it was her father's death that kind of led her in the direction of writing this book. You know, Susan, I wanted to ask you about some of the questions you had for us, but your take on, you know, because she talked about what resonated with me was how she talked about life in South Florida. And I grew up here in South Florida, so I was like, yeah, oh, I know that place. And yeah, I know about how life is handled there and how people in that neighborhood act compared to these people. And so that was kind of more the connection with me. But you're new to Florida.
Mm-hmm.
So did any of that resonate with you in any way?
It totally did, because she kind of treated the settings like she did the characters, in that none of that was throwaway stuff. And she really put you in the place. And she actually said somewhere that I was listening on the internet that she wanted to make everybody fully dimensional. And she achieved that. So circling back to your listener comment that we heard a moment ago about how you're always going to have moments where you love and you can't love these people that have these terrible addiction problems, but she still rendered her parents so fully. And so, like, for example, her mom had to get a different mailbox. She was supposed to be getting this very uniform mailbox, and she instead refused to do it, and she got a mailbox that looked like a hummingbird. And I thought, oh, this is so neat, because I was looking at it after I read it, and I said, you know what, she had a daughter that failed to conform to the societal expectations in so many ways, and she accepted the daughter on her terms.
Can I just real quickly, only because of time,
sure.
What's one question that you have for us Floridians?
Here's a question. Okay, her grandfather was driving the family here cross country. It was a cross country move, and he was nowhere near Florida yet. And he said to a stranger that he was moving to Florida, and the guy said, where? He said, I don't know. You got any suggestions? And the man says, keep driving south.
Keep going.
If you go far enough south, you'll disappear.
Yeah.
Hmm. What does that mean? Can you add anything to that?
You know what? I took it as keep driving all the way south until you get to the Keys. Mm-hmm. And then I think you just disappear at that point. And you will want to. And I think that you'll enjoy the fact that that's a different world. And you've disappeared from the rest of it, and you're disconnected. That's how I took it.
I think South Florida does feel remote. You know, I've heard a lot of people talk about, like, maybe some of the reasons why we have some of the really odd people and the moments that go viral, you know, is because, like, maybe people come to South Florida sometimes because they're running away from something.
That,
and it's like,
that's a good
as
point.
Far as they can go when they're still...
South Florida, the place to run away. I got to end it on that point. WLRN education reporter Jessica Bakeman joining us, Sundial Book Club member Susan Edgar Lee, again discussing April's book club title, Long Live the Tribe of Fatherless Girls. Remember, you can find us on Facebook. Just look up Sundial Book Club. Jessica, Susan, thanks so much.
Thank you.
All right, April is National Poetry Month. WLRN has been asking listeners to participate in Zip Odes. This is a project created by us and the O Miami Poetry Festival that encourages people worldwide to join the fun by creating a poem using your zip code. The concept is simple. Use the 5 digits of your zip code to write a poem that corresponds with each number in your zip code. And you've been sharing some of yours. Let's hear about some of them.
This is Bridget Kinney, and this is my zip ode for my Shenandoah neighborhood. 33145. Abuelo cycles, shirtless, over cassia confetti, teetering, a rimless car tire slung over one sun-browned shoulder.
A Miami moment, seeing your stolen bike in the local pawn and buying it. My name is Malari Bendas. My zip code is 33143.
Cortaditos for All is my platform when campaigning for president of the Republic of Miami. My name is Diego Abreu. I live in the Flagler area, and my zip code is 33135.
This is Rebecca Wakefield in West Little Havana. The saints lurk in every yard, backlit, quietly presiding over fountains, flags, and fat dogs.
Hi, my name is Ashley Suarez-Burgos. I live in Miami, Florida, and my zip code is 33143.
Arroz, frijoles, platanitos, pollo y pan. Abuelo thinks we are too skinny.
My name is Teresa. I live in West Kendall. My zip is 33183. Too far. Far. West Kendall is too far to visit you. You come here.
Yes, I can actually attest to that, living in West Kendall. By the way, we've selected some of those, and the people who wrote them are going to be reading them at an event coming up April 24th. That's tomorrow at Vizcaya Museum and Gardens. By the way, Jessica Bakeman will be there reading hers. All right, that's our program for today. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Always appreciate it. We'll talk to you tomorrow.